You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Oh, Don, the days are getting shorter. No, that can't be right.
By about a minute a day. Yeah, we're losing time. Better get things planted. Hurry up and get that spring and summer vegetable garden in. So today's date is June 25th, 2025, as we are recording this program. And today's temperature will be 90 degrees and sunny. Thursday, the day of the broadcast, will be 92 degrees and sunny, which I believe is the actual average high temperature for this time of year. We've been having a very balmy spring here, folks. And we are very aware of the fact that most of the rest of the United States is under a extremely strong high pressure dome, and temperatures in some of the big metropolitan areas are, let's just say, life threatening. My kid lives in New York City, went out to vote on Tuesday, and it was 100 degrees. And she went to the polling station, and the low that night, I think, was 80. And so that right there, I didn't even mention the humidity, which was probably 60 to 70%. Who knows? Just muggy as can be. That's a big difference. When we talk to you folks about, oh, it's going to be 93 degrees today, or it's going to be 97 degrees today, our humidity when that happens is, I don't know, 20%. It's uncomfortable. You might want to stand in the shade for a little while, but you're not facing grievous bodily injury simply by being outside. So we are aware that major cities in the East Coast and the Midwest are all under a distinct heat wave. Good news for them, it's going to cool off rapidly this week. They'll have thunderstorms at the end of the week. We won't have anything like that. Our temperatures will be Friday, 95 degrees, warming up a bit. Friday night, 61 degrees, little mini heat wave for the weekend. Saturday, 97 degrees. Saturday night, 59 degrees. Sunday, 96 degrees. Sunday night will be 57, Monday, 94, and Tuesday, 93. And again, 92 to 93 is our average high temperature at this time of year, with average nighttime lows in the upper 50s to around 60 degrees. Great gardening weather we've been experiencing for the last 4 to 6 weeks. Great pollination weather in your vegetable garden. Everything's flourishing well, as long as you've been watering it deeply enough. And if you're having problems with your vegetables, other than certain diseases and pests, pretty good chance because you aren't watering long enough. Someone said to me the other day, seems like one of your main messages on the Davis Garden Show is you need to water longer. Yes, that is one of our main messages on the Davis Garden Show. Sometimes you need to water more often because of a raised planter or a container situation. More commonly, you need to water more deeply. And as we've mentioned on the show, every so often, I really suggest if you have soils where this is possible, bring that soil back to field capacity, which is a technical term, but I mean, really saturate it. Let it drain out, get a good reservoir of moisture stored in your soil so the plants can tap into that for a couple to a few or even several days, depending on your soil type. And you'll do that, and then you go back to your normal drip irrigation. You'll probably find that'll correct a lot of the problems you're having, certainly a lot of the problems we're seeing at our garden center. Some problems got sent in by mail we'll talk about, but this is one of the common themes, of course, day after day with a vegetable garden especially. Need to water more deeply, not more often, more deeply. Okay, let's do that community service stuff. Then we'll talk about plants. So one, KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. That means you pay for it. You like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And while you're over there, check out some of the great programming here at KDRT. I mean, there is all kinds of new programs. We always love to see new programmers coming in, blessing us with their unique take on a particular decade or a particular genre of music or a completely eclectic mix of music. There are several shows where I guarantee if you tune in, you'll hear something you've never heard before. But there's one that I want to mention. It's been on about 5 or 6 weeks now, 10 Years Forgotten. with your host, John Emery, focuses on modern classics and indie standards from 2000 to 2010. John describes that as a decade lost to the decline of the record store industry. 10 Years Forgotten also explores the history of record stores in the Sacramento Valley. Did you all know Tower Records was from here? Including why some are still open today. It's not. Along with the future of physical and digital music, locally, regionally, and beyond. 10 Years Forgotten airs live Wednesdays, 3 to 5 p.m. New programs eventually get picked up for rebroadcast. And so to find the rebroadcast times for that or any of the other programming you love at KDRT, just click on the schedule guide.
And we usually try to tell you about some event that's happening or something that's going on in the community. Well, this is one that is perpetual. This is the Woodland Regional Park Preserve. And when I say perpetual, I mean, it's not like it's only open for a few hours or a few, you know, you just go in there anytime you want. It has walking paths around the ponds. It has viewing stations. This is not a park like you're going to play football in. This is a park like you're going to go and enjoy seeing what is around here in the summer or the winter or whenever you go. The way to get there is from Davis. Go north on Pauline Road, which turns into 102, and go on up until there's a signal light. Well, go one more signal light. There it is. On your right is the entrance to Woodland Regional Park Preserve. And if you want to know more about it, go to the cityofwoodland.gov, Woodland Regional Park Preserve.
So what we do here, we're in a valley grassland plant community where water would have gently drained from the Coast Range towards the Delta. And the low spots where water would collect, in many cases, have been accentuated. So water intentionally collects there. They become flood zones so that they will have water pooling there in the winter instead of, I don't know, residential neighborhoods across that street you drove up on. And we turn them into parks. We've got a couple of these around Davis, I think three or four of them in Davis, which are basically drainage ponds turned into West Pond, or the one in the North Davis area that we just call North Ditch is the name of one of them. North Pond, North Ditch, these are areas where water drains intentionally, and it gives you a little sense for what it used to look like here. When I moved to the Sacramento Valley from coastal Southern California, where roads actually cling to hillsides and things like that, the first most notable thing when you move here is how flat it is and how geometric everything is. The trees are in straight rows, at even spacing. The lines are all very distinct right angles, and there, here and there, you'll see what it used to look like. Glide Ranch out west of town, for example. Highway 505 is the old valley grassland land contour. Different grass species now, but the same kind of contour. And they take these and they turn some of them into floodplain parks. And that's exactly what this is. It's great for the wildlife. I'm guessing that birders are having a great time up there. And it's easy to get to and quite accessible, handicapped accessible, lots of parking, and you can't really miss it. Road 102 off to your right as you head up to Woodland. Okay, we've got questions that came in the mailbag and things to talk about.
First, I wanted to ask you our weekly questions. Yeah. What are you planting now, Don?
We are planting at our nursery. We're still planting pepitas, seeds of pumpkins that you grow for the seeds. So we like to grow those because I like to grow them. So I need to make sure I have some and we'll put them out for sale. You can still plant winter squashes. Now, I always have to define this term. We're talking about things like Hubbard squash, acorn squash. I wish we would all start calling them keeper squashes or winter keepers or something like that, because it's amazing what percentage of the public, including what percentage of even horticultural professionals, think, oh, winter squash, we plant them in the winter. No, we plant them in the summer. They're like pumpkins. We use them in the winter, right? They have tough skins. And boy, was that a useful characteristic when you were living on the plains or up in New England, mid-Atlantic states, to have something that was tough enough that you could just stick it down in your, as Lois would say, your root cellar. Not to be confused with your root cellar. See, we're from different parts of the country. And you can store it till February or March. A root. Yes, I've noticed regional differences in how we pronounce the word R-O-O-T. And the root cellar is where you would put your pumpkins that you're keeping for pies and things like that. And these squashes, you can plant them till about the 1st of July. They take about 90 days to yield and ripen. They can sit out there in the garden for another month. I mean, I've had them sitting out there, Hubbard squash and things, as long as they're not rotting on the bottom, a layer of straw or something underneath them can keep them going. They can sit right out there into November, even December. because they've got tough enough skins that they're not going to spoil, and things are usually not going to come along and eat them. I'll tell you from experience, if you wait long enough, the turkeys will discover them, which can be another fun thing in the fall, is going out and finding turkeys eating your winter squash. Anyway, you can plant winter squash now, so we're putting in a few of those, and we're already shifting over to talking about which kind of snapdragons we're going to be starting in July. Brussels sprouts to get going in end of June, early July, so people will be able to plant them out later in the month. So we are already shifting over in our thinking to the things for midsummer, late summer, and early fall planting. And if you're thinking about growing some like long stem cutting snapdragons or stock for the fragrance, start thinking about them. Look in seed catalogs now, because we generally start those July and August, believe it or not. Okay, that was a long answer to a short question, as usual.
What are you harvesting?
I am harvesting, let's see, plums, of course, are coming in hot and heavy. Santa Rosa plums, early peaches. I'm again impressed somewhat. Gold Dust peach. Gold Dust is the earliest peach that I think is any good. It's not an O. Henry quality or Rio Oso gem or Loring quality, but it's a good peach that we're harvesting in the month of June. One of my pluots called Splash is harvesting right now. It is one of the richest flavored pluots you'll find, but it's a hard one to get a hold of because the fruit is small. So I grow it. I love it. My staff loves them. Hard to find in nurseries. If you're in the California rare fruit growers and you're looking for a stone fruit to graft onto your plum or pluot to add something to your collection, Splash has got a really, really good flavor. It's just not ever going to probably be a commercial variety because the fruit size is too small. Those are two things we're harvesting right now.
Well, we've got a lot of questions, and all we always do, but this time I want to read this letter from Annie. Now, Annie is a frequent listener, or she writes frequently, I should say, and here's what she recently said. Thank you so much for your fabulous advice about my tomatoes on your last show. I did check, and there is no anywhere on the tomato branch, so I think that you're right. It's dehydration. Your explanation about field conditions, that is, watering thoroughly and completely before planting, made a lot of sense to me. I had not done that and discovered that the area of my raised bed was dry, even though it had been watered that day. I quickly remedied the situation and increased the length of time that the drip system is on. You know, Don, we need a new meme.
Water longer.
Water longer. Check daily. Water as needed. Water longer. Got it.
And he continues. Also, we have never flushed out our drip lines. Some of these have been in place for over a decade. Is it okay to do this during the summer? If so, I will get to it, as I have felt that my meters have been more clogged up than usual this year. As always, I really appreciate you, your superlative advice and fantastic explanations.
Well, thank you.
So let's go back to that emitter thing.
Yeah.
It was my understanding. Once an emitter is clogged, it's clogged. It's done. Isn't that right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, hypothetically, you could clean them out, but you'd have to remove them, soak them in some kind of solvent, and put them back in. My experience with drip systems is that when you pop an emitter out to replace it, you end up making a leak in that spot. That may or may not be a huge problem, but I just typically add a new emitter next to the old one and figure, okay, that plant gets a little more water than usual. Fine. It's never been a problem. Yeah, I have emitters that have been in place in lines that I've been using for 20 years plus. And yes, you can flush it out now. You find the end of the line, you take it off. It's best to have some kind of a threaded cap on there if you can, or at least a figure eight end enclosure. You take it off, you turn the system on, you go back down there. When I do this, an amazing amount of white dissolved salt powder stuff comes out and heaps up right at the end. That's because I'm on a well, as are many people out here in the Davis, Woodland, Dixon area. And in some communities like Dixon, the whole community is on well water. In Davis, we are mostly on surface water, but we go back to wells every now and then. So those dissolved salts can build up in the system, can precipitate out. And what happens most commonly is they precipitate out in the winter when you're not running your drip system. You turn it on for the first time, and then all that dissolved powdery stuff tries to go through the emitters and it plugs them. If you're lucky, it flushes through. If you're not lucky, it plugs them. It may clear itself out, but you can't really count on it. So yes, go ahead and take the end off, turn it on for, I usually find 5 to 10 minutes. I just set the end someplace where a plant will benefit from that. it's not harmful. The calcium deposits are not particularly harmful to plants. They're in the water all the time here. So I'll just stick the end of it next to a tree or a shrub nearby and go ahead and flush it through. Take a look at what comes out. It's pretty impressive what you're removing. If you don't do it, it plugs the emitter. So you may need to add new emitters next to or on the same line as your old ones just to make sure each plant is getting the water that it needs. Absolutely fine to do that now, but really good to reiterate this. Two points: run your system longer if you have to, just rather than more frequently if you possibly can. I really prefer deeper irrigation. That field capacity thing, it's a technical term, but I think it's an important concept to understand. The amount of available water we can store in our soil here is pretty amazing because we have reasonably dense soils. If you have sandy soil, water runs straight through it. If you have clay soil, water barely percolates in and spreads out. And so the wetted profile in sandy soils versus clay soils, very, very different. Water goes out before it goes down in a clay soil because of the size of the particles. Clay is tiny, tiny, tiny. Sand is like rocks by comparison with clay, and water runs straight into sand. Most people in the area have a loam soil, which is a misunderstood term. Most people hear the word loam and they think, oh, soil with lots of organic stuff in it. No, loam is simply intermediate between clay and sand. It is a blend of particle sizes. We're just talking tiny rocks here. We're not talking about the organic stuff at all. So most people here have silty loam, sandy loam, or clay loam. Lois, for example, lives in an area of town that's got fine sandy loam, some of the best agricultural soil in the entire planet. My soil is silty loam. Silt is smaller than sand, so water doesn't go in as quickly. It spreads out more, but not as much as clay. People in West Davis, North Davis, up towards Woodland, other parts of town, Binning Tract, specific subdivisions have clay loam soils, trending towards the clay end of clay loam. That means it's clay with some silt and sand particles in it. So in clay soils, water will start to go in. There's a poor infiltration rate. It'll back up. It'll flow out over the surface. It'll run off, and you aren't watering the plant unless you slow down your irrigation rate to a trickle. It will hold a lot of moisture once you've watered thoroughly. So one advantage of clay loam and silty loam soils is you can give a really thorough soaking if you adapt to the infiltration rate and store a bunch of water in there. In theory, on my farm with a silty loam, which is intermediate, I can put on a week's worth of water for an annual crop like a vegetable garden at a time. I can thoroughly soak everything, and there's enough moisture down there that the plant's roots will explore and take up moisture for a full week. Whereas in sandy loam soil, if I were gardening at Lois's property, for example, you probably have to water twice a week because it just runs through and out of the root zone. I had my first introduction of this was a customer in South Davis who put in a drip system using my fairly standard technique of a dripper every 2 feet. And he was going to plant strawberries, and he planted strawberries every foot. And he brought me a picture of alternately wilted strawberry plants. Okay, so one was near the emitter and one was between the emitters. 2 feet apart in my soil, if I run that for an hour, the whole zone is wet. The whole line of drip irrigation is wet. He couldn't do that. He went back. I said, well, there's a really simple answer here, obviously. Put an emitter every foot. And that's what he did. But it did illustrate the difference in water penetration and storage of a sandy loam soil versus a silty loam soil versus a clay loam soil. But in any event, a very thorough soaking, lots and lots of gallons of water every so often will give you a reservoir. You'll bank some water against future water needs, and then you can go back to using your drip irrigation system, which you're probably using at somewhat of a deficit. You're never quite perfect with a drip irrigation system. They don't distribute perfectly, but it'll be adequate because you've banked some extra water in there. So that's really what I'm getting at when I talk about field capacity.
I have a question about that clay loam soil or clay soils. And I know you've said that when you put the water on top, it doesn't penetrate fast enough so that it runs off to the side. It goes to the side instead of down. Mm-hmm. So here's my question. If I don't have that situation, but if I did, what would you think about modifying a French drain? That is to say, and for those of you who don't know a French drain, it's a way to keep the water from standing in puddles. You take a post hole digger, you make a hole, you put rocks in it so that the water has a place to rush down. But if you didn't do that 3 feet down, you just did it maybe, I don't know, a foot and a half, would that allow the water then to penetrate to the side?
Somewhat, although again, you still have the same high density soil, so it will back up pretty quickly and just overflow the hole that you've dug. But where we've done that, we've done what you described. I remember one customer whose neighbor's watering was going to kill their cherry tree. Cherries are very sensitive to overwatering in the sense of frequency of irrigation, very vulnerable to phytophthora is what we mean by that. Moisture was standing around the crown of this cherry tree every single day. I've learned over many years, conversations between neighbors about watering generally aren't very productive. Okay. And this was not going to be. They weren't going to change their watering. They didn't even understand the conversation. So I looked at this beautiful cherry tree that was going to be killed by the neighbor's watering. And we took a post hole digger and we went about 4 feet out. Lois is describing perfectly. We took this regular clamshell type post hole digger. We dug down as deep as it would go, which in the case of that one was 3 to 4 feet. It was a big job. We took a bunch of cobble, which is like large gravel, and we filled that hole. We took the dirt out of the hole and put it somewhere else. That went away because we didn't have a need for that extra dirt right there. That way, whenever, and they watched it happen. The next time the neighbor turned on the irrigation, it was one of these, let me know how it goes. Oh, we will. And they went out there and they watched. The water flowed in and it flowed towards the cherry and it flowed over and it filled up the hole. And it filled up the hole completely, and that's fine. But all the surplus water went away from the crown of the tree. So we actually saved that tree with a simple post hole digger and some rock. What you're describing is also a method people sometimes use for getting water deeper. It's usually guys that want to do this. I'm planting a tree and I bought some 2-inch PVC and I'm going to drill some holes in it. And I'm going to put it down. And I'm going to fill it with gravel and I'm going to water that. And I said, that's just splendid. That's absolutely great. You go ahead and do that, but be sure to water the tree itself too, because the roots of the tree you're putting in are up here and you've just put in a thing that takes the water down there. So we need to keep watering the nursery soil and the nursery roots until the tree gets more thoroughly established. There is nothing wrong with making a method, just a mechanical method for taking the water deeper to the root zone, but it doesn't obviate your need for irrigating the existing shallower roots. And no matter what you do, unless you, well, there's no way to avoid this. Most of the roots of the tree, remember, are in the top foot to foot and a half. So going deeper is helpful. You'll get more deep roots. You'll get a higher percentage of them going deeper if you get moisture down there. And a mechanical method of making that better penetration certainly is fun to pursue. I never talk people out of it. I do feel like saying you could just put a drip system in, run it longer. That would accomplish much the same thing, but if you have heavy soil and you're running it longer and it's backing up and flowing off multiple start times on the same day, if it takes 2 hours to irrigate a good depth, but within 30 to 45 minutes, it's beginning to flow away from where you want it to go, then have your timer come on 3 to 4 times for 30 to 45 minutes in the same day. So increased duration may require multiple start times. Our aphorisms are getting complicated here, but we'll certainly revisit this one. But multiple start times are often the answer. When I'm talking to people about how to water deeper, and I'm saying you could put a hose on it. You could put a sprinkler out there to bypass your system. And I see them beginning to glaze over and think, oh my God, my yard is going to be I'm going to have to spend all weekend out watering my yard. I say, or just have your system go through another cycle. You know, maybe that's the easy answer. Just go out there and manually turn it on to go through another cycle every now and then. If I were timing that, I would do it right before a heat wave, because then you'd have the extra moisture that you might need during a heat wave or a windy spell. Better, of course, to water in a more strategic manner. I'm not a big fan of irrigation systems because of the problems that they do cause. We see a lot of those problems, but sometimes just running the whole thing through another cycle, or find that little knob on the valve, which you can use to turn on the valve. You've run the system, go out and turn it on by hand, let it run for another hour or two and really give things a good soaking. This is not a huge amount of water. Drip systems put out water slowly. They're putting out 1 to 2 gallons per hour at each point. That's a tenth, that's a 50th of what a sprinkler is putting out. So it's not wasting water to do this. It's leading to healthier trees and better results on deep-rooted annual plants like tomatoes.
So if you have a question or a comment or a suggestion or a brag, oh, we love to hear those brags, or some compliments, those are good too. You can write to us at any time that you'd like, and it's at where, Don?
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
And Arthur wrote to us at DavisGardenShow@gmail.com. And wrote, "Thank you for your very informative show. I was wondering if you could help me diagnose what appears to be a wilting disease on a Lilium pardalinum plant in San Mateo County. At a certain point on the stem, see photo attached, the plant has just shriveled up and turned brown. Is this a known recognizable disease to which lilies are subject in our area? If so, is there anything I can do about it? My attempts to research this online have mostly come up empty. In case it's relevant, the plant is growing at the edge of a small perennial stream, and the other plants in the same area are mostly healthy, though a few others seem to have the same affliction. Thank you very much." And the photo that was sent, I had to really blow this up quite a bit to see, but the brown part is a flower, and where the flower is there, it's blackened, and then a little bit further down where it is the stem of the plant, that's also blackened, but we're only talking maybe a few inches of plant, and below that it looks fine.
Yeah, so there are a lot of diseases that affect lily plants, in fact, and in the florist industry, these are a big issue because you have plants crowded in a greenhouse. Where if you get a bacterial disease in particular, it comes in, it's on the soil or something, it splashes onto the plant under high temperature, high moisture conditions is the biggest factor. Lilies are almost always from high moisture environments. And it will infect very rapidly under favorable conditions, and a big, big issue for the floriculture industry. Those who grow lilies for not just cut flowers, but also for selling as plants. This looks to me from your picture like a bacterial disease that infected the base of the blossom and some of the nearby leaves. And that's it. Most of these are very localized infections when they occur. If you have a greenhouse full of plants, you're going to freak out. You're going to run out and you're responsible for a high value cash crop. You're going to go look for whatever prophylactic type disease prevention you can come up with to spray the plants nearby to prevent it from splashing to them. You're going to isolate that plant, or you're going to remove it from the greenhouse almost surely. In your own garden situation, I've occasionally seen this type of thing. I grow lilies all the time. Don't have a lot this year, but I've had as many as 30 or 40 plants in the past because it's one of my favorite flowers. And every now and then I'll do overhead watering as they're coming into bloom, and one of the blossoms will do what you're seeing here, which is a bacterial infection at the base of the flower. It rarely goes beyond that. That's the good news. If you did get a rainstorm right now or had really drizzly weather and then it warmed up suddenly, I would expect it to spread pretty quickly. That's why greenhouses are such a problem. That's in fact why one of the management strategies in greenhouses is to avoid overhead watering in this situation. They only water the soil. They never water the foliage in a greenhouse because the humidity is high, the temperature is high, conditions are very favorable for bacterial and fungal disease infection and spread. And many of these things spread by splashing. In your garden, if you've got reasonable air movement, airflow, it's out there where there's actual breezes occurring, and we're having what you might call normal California weather, I don't think this is going to be a continuing problem or a serious problem on your stand of Lilium pardalinum. By the way, kudos on having that. It's a wonderful flower. It's a native lily for California. You could get a bit more of it on that plant. The simple thing to do for a home gardener or someone concerned about this is prune out the affected portion, bag it up, and throw it away. And that'll probably stop the whole thing in its tracks. One dry north wind here in the valley will stop these things in their tracks. So this is a big advantage we have in the West, is that we have spells of low humidity and low moisture that prevent the spread of these diseases. You'll get a brief infection and then the problem passes. We see this very similar phenomenon on a lot of woody trees. I mean, someone sent me a picture of their Japanese maple back in May where parts of it had died back. Up on the plant, one branch here, one branch there. That's a localized infection of an airborne disease. Could be two or three different things, usually fungal in the case of maples. Ash trees get similar problems. There's lots of these diseases that spread when we have rain in the spring. And good news for us is they spread, you get a little infection, you prune it out, that's the end of it. I believe you have a bacterial disease. I don't think it's going to be a huge problem for you.
So you said a dry north wind would kill the bacteria, right?
Or certainly prevent it from spreading, yeah.
So what about if I had a big long extension cord and took the hair out of there? Would that solve it? Or I should just cut this down 2 inches below where it is infected?
In theory, your proposal actually is valid. There's formulas for how many air exchanges you need to have in a greenhouse to keep it healthy. And one of the simplest things you learn when you're doing plant propagation is that any of a number of disease problems that you get under the conditions that you've created are highly favorable for disease, infection, and spread when you're doing like seedlings and rooting cuttings, and you got all this moisture, and it's very high temperature, and you got warm benches. One of the key things is to just set up a fan nearby where we start the plants in our head house at our shop. We have a little tiny computer fan, you know, one of those little things that is like a 3-inch fan, and we have it set up. You can even plug it into your computer. It comes with a USB adapter, and point it towards the general area where the seedlings are. Don't put a great big gale force wind there. You'll have to dry, you'll have to water them all the time, but that air circulation is crucial. And yes, in theory, you could take a hair dryer out there or a leaf blower, stand there with a leaf blower long enough to desiccate it. I would suggest it's letting nature run its course, but yes, sunlight and air movement are the enemies of disease. So if you've got a problem, obviously you don't take a shade plant and put it in the sun to correct a disease problem, you'd create another problem. But increasing airflow, and very commonly, all that means is pruning away some of the nearby plants to get better air circulation in there. You know, opening it up for a little more sunlight so that you get sunlight directly striking the plant, because the ultraviolet rays are actually very effective disease control. So better air movement, removing the affected portions, pretty much all you need to do, unless you've got a 100-foot extension cord and a good hair dryer and you want to stand out there and take care of the problem that way.
Well, up next we have dead parts on Japanese maples. You mentioned something. I don't know if this is the same thing or not, mm-hmm. but the plants are in a pot in a shady area using Don's favorite potting mix. And not from the base, but from further up, parts of some branches are dead. There occurs a dark area in and around surrounding the branch, and then everything above that spot dies.
Yeah.
See attached pictures.
Excellent.
This yes, the little maple over is fine.
The little maple in the next pot over is fine. So this is just a localized infection on a single Japanese maple plant or a little group of Japanese maples.
No, just one. Yeah.
I occasionally get this on mine. Remember, I have more Japanese maples than a normal person should have. And when we have a wet spring with intermediate temperatures, I'll suddenly get a branch dying and I'll just go in and prune it out. I did have once, rather tragically, it infected right at the graft union. So everything above the graft union died, which was the variety I had, you know, wanted. And it resprouted from the roots. Most Japanese maples are grafted onto seedling Acer palmatum. I didn't really need another one of those. But that was an unusual situation where the infection was of great consequence because it hit the graft union. More commonly, and this is a really good picture, I don't know for sure if this is Botryosphaeria or Cercospora or one of a couple of other fungal diseases that can attack with airborne spores. Usually happens when there's high moisture. So we usually see this high moisture and warmish temperatures. So we usually see this kind of thing late March, April, maybe early into May. And then almost invariably here, we warm up fast enough and the daytime humidity gets low enough that these things just are stopped in their tracks. So this is a good example of one where we get a little infection, print it out, end of problem. But yes, you should go below that point. For those of you who know fire blight on apple trees and things like that, this it looks very similar, except that it's just a little area that's affected, and then everything past that point withers and dies. So that's what you notice. We call it flagging in the business. You're looking at a seemingly healthy tree, and one branch is dead. That tells us that there's a point of infection that you can almost always find. Go below that into healthy wood, cut out that portion, bag it up, send it to the dump or whatever. You know, your burn pile is probably fine if you're out in the country and have one of those, but take it away from the area. Do you need to clean your pruners? I doubt it. I mean, I seriously don't think that's absolutely necessary, but if you got a little alcohol-based wipe, go ahead and clean them off. Good idea to clean your pruners every now and then anyway, but that's not the primary way something like this is going to infect. This is a spore that blew in, splashed in, infected, killed a little bit, probably done at this point because we're now getting into low humidity every single afternoon here in the valley. We're not going to have a rainstorm coming in to make this get worse. We're not going to see rain probably till end of October at this point. So the likelihood of fungus diseases spreading is pretty slim.
So the thing about the pruners, if I'm cutting healthy wood, I don't see any reason I would need to clean my pruners.
Correct.
Okay.
That's one of those recommendations you see constantly. You know, clean your pruners after each cut. I don't think that's a common source of infection. I know in the cases of things like fire blight, attempts to determine whether it was a source of infection generally proved negative. It's not the kind, it's just one of those precautions. Is it the end of the world if you don't clean? I doubt if you're spreading it at all.
So the next question is, this is in a pot. Mm-hmm. And if the pot holes in the bottom got plugged up and the pot got stayed wet for a long time.
Is this your tree, Lois?
Yes, I even signed it this time. Oh, okay. It's Lois and Davis, you see?
This question is coming in from Lois and Davis, who sent it to davisgardenshow@gmail.com, as you can do too.
Right, I did.
Okay.
But if the pot were too damp for too long, would that be a source of the infection?
Well, there's a difference between too damp and a bog. A bog would not be good for the plant. That's definitely the case. Although I don't think that caused this. This looks like it was an actual, you know, blown in rainy season infection that just took hold and did a little bit of damage. It is definitely not good to grow Japanese maples in standing water. If you're going to grow a tree in standing water, bald cypress comes to mind as a possibility.
It wasn't intentional, huh? I did clean out the drain hole in the bottom, and it is now draining, but I think it's hard to tell how much water is coming out of those little mini sprinkler things.
It is, yeah.
And I think it just is staying really wet.
Well, Japanese maples do like even moisture, but bog-like conditions would not be optimal. If it otherwise looks healthy and there's one branch is dying, prune that out and you're probably good to go. I had a question that came my way. We'll go ahead and answer this one right now. It's another tree question that didn't actually get mailed in. I just noticed it in my email this morning. It was from Arash, who is a regular listener, and he was asking what I think about linden trees. Are you familiar with linden trees, Lois?
In Germany.
And here we have them. We have them in Davis, and there are actually some on campus, and there's a couple of streets where it was the street tree. Also, linden was one of the very first trees I planted on my farm when we moved here in 1985. I've been here 40 years now. And so I have a 40-year-old linden tree in my backyard. Tilia cordata is the most common one that you see in this area, little leaf linden. And it just finished its bloom. You've never seen a tree so alive with bees as a linden tree in bloom. And apparently it makes wonderful honey as well. It has a great fragrance to it, a very sweet smell. This is one of these ones where it's one of my favorite trees, but you're not going to find them at my nursery, and I'm not going to highly recommend it. So let's go through that very quickly. Beautiful, very uniform growth habit. I mean, it's got a classic, almost Christmas tree shape for many, many years, a strongly X-current growth habit, as we call it, then gradually more rounded, but even still, looks formal. I've never done any pruning on this except to take the branches up and out of the way. And it looks like what I like to call an architect's rendering of a tree. It's one of those absolutely classic tree shape. Fragrant blossoms, massively attractive to bees. I mean, all of the tilias are all the little leaf linden, the Crimean linden, which there's a couple of on campus. These are wonderful leafy trees that look very much like they're from Scandinavia or the upper Midwest or New England. And indeed, they are high water trees. So one thing I will say about linden is they need to be in a place where they'll get consistent irrigation their whole life. When I backed off on watering my tree at one point because of some changes in the backyard, the edges of the leaves burnt and it became pretty unsightly. Didn't kill the tree, but it, you know, it's like maples. They can look a little rough in that situation. The main thing about lindens is they always get aphids. And you need to be aware that the ground underneath a linden tree will typically be kind of sticky. And while many people would want to go out and apply a systemic to control the aphids, that would kill bees. And bees are very attracted to linden trees when they're in bloom. In fact, there have been some pretty spectacular bee kills where people have applied imidacloprid and other systemics to linden trees because they were being, you know, there's sticky stuff on a parking lot. This up in Oregon, this happened very dramatically. And the next day people came in and found thousands of dead bumblebees on the ground. And that landscaper got cited for an inappropriate off-label use, but the damage was done. So you need to be aware that like many other trees, they get aphids, it's consistent, they will get it every year. So if you put it someplace, be aware that you're going to get a sticky residue underneath the tree. I've just let grass grow there because I think the tree is beautiful and I don't really care. So I don't have tables or chairs or anything underneath it. So high water, aphid problem is a concern. Very attractive to bees, beautiful tree if it will have consistent irrigation. And the one that we generally sell in the valley is the little leaf linden, Tilia cordata, the variety called Green Spire, which was just selected for a relatively uniform growth habit. But I need you to be aware of that aphid problem because it's a nuisance pest. But when we use the term nuisance pest, it sounds like, oh, well, you can put up with it. Nuisance pest includes aphids, which cause the whole surface to be covered with a sticky residue. So that would be a negative with respect to Tilia cordata. There are the street tree on I Street, parts of I Street. And there's some bigger ones, the bigger leaf linden types, so the Crimean linden, I believe. on campus, a couple of them in places that I remember from a number of years ago. And it's just one of these big, beautiful trees with a nice medium green color and very attractive to bees. And one phenomenon I've seen on my tilia every summer, it'll happen sometime soon, is if you go out on a warm day, because of all those aphids, a warm evening, I should say, because of all those aphids, you'll see lace wings. And I have stood there with a flashlight and seen what appear to be hundreds of lace wings floating up and down on the air currents inside the tree, then going in and ovipositing. And I find lace wing eggs on those distinctive stalks that they're on by the hundreds on my linden tree. So if you are a permaculture person looking for a tree to put in that's going to draw beneficials and you don't mind the sticky drip, you know the irrigation will be there, great choice. Just be aware of that sticky nuisance drip. This will breed beneficial insects for the rest of your yard and all your neighbors' yards because it's so attractive to the lace wings. But it's also very attractive to aphids, and you're likely to see a lot of ants going up in the tree. One way to minimize the aphid problem is to kill the ants that are going up the tree on the trunk by whatever means you are okay with.
This is the pollinator question. We're doing that one first?
Yeah, we'll do as much of it as we can. There's a number of segments to this. So
this is from Andrew, and he writes, Happy National Pollinator Week, which is from June 16th through the 22nd. And so we thought this would be a timely time to start. Yeah. So I have a few questions. How can I attract pollinators to my garden and keep them in my garden year-round?
Okay, now let's take these sort of one segment at a time. The very simple answer to that is have lots of things blooming all the time.
And okay? don't spray poison.
Yeah, there's a lot of other, don't spray pesticides and don't do hard pruning on things constantly. You know, when I walk into yards and I see clipped boxwood hedges, well, there's nothing wrong with boxwood, but have you ever seen it bloom? It actually has a flower that's attractive to bees, I would imagine. But if it's pruned all the time, you'll never see it bloom. I mean, here's a classic example of a plant that I detest, but let's give it its due. Privet. Privets are extremely attractive to butterflies when you let them bloom. Some of us don't like them because privets are closely related to olives. And if you're allergic to olives, there's a pretty good chance you'll be allergic to privets. And privets also reseed like crazy, but they attract butterflies, not if you're pruning them all the time. But the main thing is, as many different things blooming as much of the time as you possibly can. That's probably the simplest answer, is to have flowers have an abundance of flowers all the time and places for them to rest and have babies. So that may be grasses nearby for the moisture that they provide, thanks to guttation and other physiological issues with them. It may be the density of a shrub that you're not pruning so that you have places for them to rear their babies and have families and so forth. So that's really the key, is a more informal yard, pruned more lightly, no spraying, and as many flowers as you can imagine.
Okay. So the next is, how do I create and sustain a habitat for ground nesting bees? Or are they just on their own in the making of their own habitat? Can they exit the ground through mulches of compost, bark, chip drops? Should I leave a spot of bare ground for their access to the sky? Do they need moist or dry soil to thrive? What do they eat to survive?
These are normal bees. Ground nesting bees are very cool, and we have a lot of native ground nesting bees here on my property. For example, every summer, right about June, July, I start finding the digger bees. The name is appropriate. I find the males clustered on blossoms of verbena or lavender, plants like that. I'll find 20 or 30 of these brightly striped bees all clustered together, crowded together on the blossom at the end of the day as we get towards dusk, towards sunset and dusk. And those are the males of the digger bee, because the females are in the ground somewhere nearby. And when they go into the ground, they don't let the men come with them. So they have ground nests nearby in fairly loose soil. It does have to be reasonably loose for them to dig their holes to some degree, and there can't be any mulch on it. So this is important. We've told you how beneficial it is to put chip drop type mulch all over your yard, except leave an area that isn't covered. And they want moisture nearby, but they don't want soggy soil. So they want soil that they can dig in readily. And these are small organisms. They dig in readily than something that's a half inch long. So you need some areas that you don't mulch. You leave them open. And that's really important for the ground nesting bees. So when you get that chip drop delivery, spread it wherever you want, but just make sure somewhere maybe in the back where there's moisture nearby, but the soil is a little bit on the loose end, you pull the mulch back so that the ground nesting bees can go in and out. What they feed on is the same thing other bees feed on, which is nectar and things like that. And so they're basically the same as others, but they're not aggressive. When I first found 30 plus years ago, one of these big clusters of 20 or 30 of these bees all crowded on one blossom inflorescence of verbena, I just carefully snipped it off and put it in a jar, and they didn't even move. They don't even have stingers. Those are the males in the case of the digger bee. I'm sure some of these are capable of stinging, but they're not aggressive in any way. These are not ground-dwelling hornets, for example. These are bees. They're actually more like honeybees. And so they're not going to come boiling out of the ground and sting you, but they do need to live in the ground somewhere nearby. And these are really important pollinators that often get overlooked in all the discussion of the importance of pollinators. As one article said about 10 years ago, maybe we're worried about the wrong bees. European honeybees are a managed farm animal. European honeybees are a crop, basically. They travel. They're a migratory workforce. They go from North Dakota to Texas to Arizona to California to Oregon to Washington back to North Dakota on trucks in boxes. Their lives are pretty well regulated by the people that own them. Yeah, they have problems and concerns that you've all heard about. But the ones that live here, that are native here, that are dwelling in the ground or in the siding, like the leafcutter bees, the native ones, which we have both native and non-native, those are not ever figuring as heavily in all these conversations about bees that we need to conserve. They probably are more important in many ways for many flowers. You know, for things in your garden, they could be as important as honeybees, and in some cases, probably even more important because of specialized adaptations. So making places, leaving the stem of your Shasta daisy after you've cut off the blossom, that hollow stem is a nesting site for certain types of bees. If you see them going into some siding on a building that you don't care about with the leafcutter bees, let them do it. They're not doing any harm when they do that. Bumblebees don't do any harm in your garden. They're entirely beneficial. So there's never really a reason to be concerned about these. Vespids are a different conversation because they are wasps. They're hornets. They're dangerous to you and other people if they happen to be in an area where you want to do things. These bees are not aggressive, and they're all beneficial. So figuring out their different lifestyles, different life cycles, and where they overwinter, where they have their families, can be very important. What sequentially flowering plants will attract, feed, and retain hummingbirds the year round? And you know what? The same question applies to pollinators. If you're trying to get bees and things in your garden, now you don't absolutely need it year round in the case of honeybees. They don't really need to be out there in December necessarily. But if you want to bring out our native bees, for example, early in the season, as the fruit trees are coming into bloom, I had a conversation with a UC Davis entomologist many years ago. He called me up to say, we're trying to help our almond growers figure out if they can plant some trees and shrubs that will draw the native bees out early to perhaps reduce their pollination costs, because at that time putting out 4 to 5 bee boxes per acre, whatever it was an expensive thing then. It was getting more expensive, and so they were trying to figure out if there was a way to augment the native pollinators. Well, same question. What do you have that's blooming in January, February that might draw native bees out to get them into the orchards by planting them as hedgerows or nearby? That would bring them in, and then the almonds will be blooming and they'll be there already. Get it? Little pun there, they'll be there already. Don't shake your head at me. That was a dad joke.
You got to be prepared.
Be prepared. Yeah, the bees out early. And so I thought, yeah, we had a great conversation. Acacia is a good example. Acacia baileyana, which blooms in January. Flowering quince, which is closely related to almonds. Chenomale japonica. The flowering apricot, the umi apricot, which is used, the fruit is actually used for pickling and brining, but it blooms very, very early. Every year, someone will bring in a picture. I saw this tree blooming in the arboretum. What is it? It's incredible. It's the flowering apricot. So it's something that blooms before the almonds or with them, overlaps with them. Pyrus kawakami, one of the ornamental pears that doesn't have a whole lot of negatives. It's sometimes called the evergreen pear. It's another one. It starts blooming in December. So there are things you can get, woody plants that you can get that are blooming midwinter to late winter that would help to bring native pollinators out, or just be there when they put the bee boxes out. My neighbor would drop his bee boxes for his almonds in late January, often as much as 10 to 14 days ahead of when the almonds are blooming, because that was just what was convenient for the beekeeper to bring them by and drop them. I was the only one that had any kind of a garden nearby. And so my camellias and my flowering quints were covered with bees. I would be out there. They'd be like trying to pull the buds of the camellia open to get in there and get some pollen out of there. And this is an important part of it. We've had droughts. We've had many years here that we've been here where there've been pretty profound drought. We had one January with no rainfall just a few years ago. In a 10-year period, we had two rather severe droughts. When they would drop those boxes before the almonds were blooming, they were all over every water source on my property. My dog water bowl in the backyard was ringed with bees. I would find them drowning in you know, standing water that I had left out there, and I would drain that out. So it is important to have some moisture during drought years, especially if we go long 2-3 weeks without any rainfall. We didn't need to feed them. We were doing that with the flowers. Even the mustard in the field was beneficial to them at that point. But you will notice as you're looking at those bee boxes that they have a formula that's stuck on the top that's dripping, draining in to feed the bees. So they do give them some food to get them started. But you can help get the bees out early, especially the native bees out early, by planting things that bloom early. Now, the question of year-round bloom, well, that's where redwoodbarn.com can be very helpful to you. One of the very first articles way back when Lois first set up the website for Redwood Barn, that was 1998, I think it was, one of the very first articles that we put up there. It looks like it's a very old article. Plants to attract hummingbirds and butterflies. Mm-hmm. Plants that attract hummingbirds. Now, this is just an alphabetical listing, but it's redwoodbarn.com/attract.html. Can't miss it. Go to a little Google search thing. You can just type in hummingbirds. It's one of the first that will come up. There's a PDF version that you can print on as well with a photo by Lois Richter of an Anna's hummingbird at her feeder. And it has the plants by annuals, perennials, vines, shrubs, and trees listed alphabetically. So that's a good starting point. So
that's for the specifically for the hummingbirds.
Right.
Then you did another article, which is about flowering plants all year round.
Right.
And that's a really good article too. Let me see if I can get the URL on that one.
I've got it here. It's at redwoodbarn.com/DE, which just tells you that it was a Davis Enterprise article, _flowerborder.html. But I'll tell you what I did to find this was I just typed in the little Google box, flowers year round, and this came up. And this one has plants that bloom late spring through fall. There's some things that bloom, you know, all season. Plants that bloom in particular seasons, which they are, which are easy to grow, and some for warm season, some for cool season. When I've helped people work these things out for their own gardens or for commercial projects where they want to have annual flowers all the time, I tell you that basically, if you plant 5 times a year, just going out every couple months, pulling the spent annuals, putting in new ones, you can have a beautiful annual border year round. If you don't want to do all that work, if you go out 2-3 times a year and start increasing the perennials that are in there, but making a point of looking for the challenging times of year to get the ones that are a little more difficult, talk about that in a moment, and increasing things that work and figuring out what works on your irrigation schedule. If it's a low water landscape, there's plants that work, but if it's a more conventional landscape, there's other plants that'll work. Whatever works, start doing more of that. There are things that can bloom every month of the year here. You know, another resource for that, the Redwood Barn calendar, which is there, redwoodbarn.com. Those pictures, each picture was taken in the month in which it is shown. So that's one other way you can do it. And I'd send you over to my own personal Instagram page. I'm don.shore, S-H-O-R, on Instagram. And I just post every day or so whatever flower I took a picture of most recently that I think is the best picture I took in the last couple of days. So if you scroll through that, it'll give you some ideas. There are some real key plants that come up over and over again. Lois's absolute favorite plant is
a butylon,
and it blooms every month of the year and it attracts hummingbirds. So
it even blooms indoors if you
if you want to draw the hummingbirds indoors, you could.
No. Stop that. Never leave your door open. You do not want to have a hummingbird in your house. Yes. It is a scary and sad situation.
Yes, they get tangled and stuff. We had that problem in San Diego. The what's nice about the abutilon is it's a plant that blooms, as I say, every month of the year, but especially, you know, starts as early as February and is blooming all the way into November and is still trying to put out blooms December, January, even when we're surprisingly cold. I'll tell you.
And this is a Davis thing. A butte lawn isn't every all year long in other places. If there's snow on the ground, there's no butte lawn. Guaranteed.
Definitely need to bring it indoors in those places. Yes.
No, you just need to plant a new one the next year.
So if you want to, you know, if you want to follow the old rules of looking for plants with tubular flowers, sure. I mean, there's no question they're very attracted to plants with tubular flowers. Yes, they are attracted to red flowers. Someone told me years ago that blue and purple, they perceive the same as red. And I've observed that, yes, blue and purple flowers are very attractive. So just if you find something that's a really key successful plant, just plant more of those. Lantana is a good example. Penstemons are very attractive to them, abutilon. But the key, the difficult times that I would urge you to focus on are mid to late winter, December, January, you know, there's not that much blooming.
Euryops.
Yeah, Euryops is a good example. It's bright yellow, so it doesn't fit the rules, but boy, they definitely go to those flowers.
And it's a daisy type plant, which means it has little tubes, that central part, like sunflowers. The central part, that's all tube flowers.
Yeah, and Euryops, the golden bush daisy in our climate, starts blooming October and just finished up in May. So that gets you through the winter. The other challenging time here in the valley, this is true in interior Southern California, places where it's just hot and dry and you may have been cutting back on your irrigation, it's August to September. All the stuff you put in April, May, the marigolds and this stuff are blooming out and they're all, by August, they may be looking a little tired and you just don't have as many things blooming then. I will say this is one of the reasons I'm a fan of zinnias, because zinnias will continue midsummer to the end of summer. Cosmos starts blooming heavily for me August, September, continues into October. Our native Zauschneria, the California fuchsia, Epilobium is the where it's been moved to, but we all like Zauschneria as the old name better. California fuchsia, classic hummingbird flower, orange, red, tubular flowers. I mean, you can't go wrong with that one. It spreads, so be aware of that when you plant it. It's a real spreader. Those two periods, December, January, and August, September, for us, are the challenging times. Wherever you're listening, you may have periods where you just don't get as much bloom in the garden. So that's the time to go down to the nursery when it's looking a little bleak out there and buy something in bloom. If you're in USDA zones 9 or 10, you could completely satisfy the hummingbird needs in your garden with the genus Salvia. You can have the things that start blooming in here in the late summer into the fall, like Salvia lacantha, the Mexican sage, very commonly has blooms still hanging on there. By the way, the hummingbirds don't care how the plants look. They don't care if the plant's flopping all over the place and is looking shaggy. As long as there's flowers on there, they're fine with it. So you might hold off on that cutting back thing until they're just completely bloomed out. I've had Salvia lacantha, the purple Mexican sage, go right through the winter and still blooming February when you finally go, yeah, you're getting a little overgrown. I'm going to go ahead and cut you back. There's salvias, our native ones here in California, bloom generally starting in March, April heavily and into May. And that's kind of their period. And just as they're finishing up, the southwestern sages, Salvia greggii, Microphylla, ones that are sold, the hybrids that are sold as Jamesonii, a couple other species, start blooming heavily midsummer and into the fall, hence the name autumn sage. But the new hybrids in that group bloom all the time. They're in bloom when they come in March. They're in bloom when they come in November. So with the genus Salvia, in our climate, you can easily get blooms completely year-round. And most places, there's even a Salvia that grows in Montana or Canada. I mean, there are types that you can grow even in much, much colder climates. Anything in the mint family in general, but Salvias in particular, are going to be very effective.
So we close our show with a quote. This one is from A.J. Balfour. "What a desolate place would be the world without a flower. It would be a face without a smile, a feast without a welcome."
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.